This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. This hour, a conversation with Karl Rove, President Bush's top political advisor. Karl Rove has helped engineer both of the president's successful presidential campaigns. But as Mr. Bush comes to the home stretch of his time in the White House, he's having much less success at getting a majority, either in Congress or in the public, to back his policies. And so, as you'll hear this hour on Word for Word, much of Karl Rove's recent appearance at the Aspen Ideas Festival had him defending the president on issues such as Iraq, immigration reform, and climate change. The Aspen Ideas Festival, where Karl Rove spoke, is a week-long series of speeches, conversations, and panel discussions. It draws together big names such as former President Bill Clinton, former Secretary of State Colin Powell, and cycling legend Lance Armstrong, along with a number of leading figures from the business world, the arts, and academia. Karl Rove appeared on stage with Walter Isaacson, the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, as well as the author of a recent biography of Albert Einstein. Here, then, Walter Isaacson and Karl Rove on July 8th.
Well, let's leap right in. Next year, are we going to be withdrawing troops from Iraq and redefining that mission?
My sense is, yes, we will be redefining the mission because the goal of the surge was to get us to a place where we could redefine the mission, to take it to something close to what Baker Hamilton says, which is, our goal is to be in a place where the United States' principal role is to help protect the territorial integrity of Iraq, to hunt down al-Qaeda and jihadist elements, to assist and train the Iraqi army, and to provide force protection to our assets there. And the object is, how do you get there? And we were getting there in 05 and 06 until the Samarra bombing, which set off a wave of sectarian violence that plunged Baghdad into disarray and made it impossible for the government to take steps towards reconciliation and even to control its own territory. So the surge is an effort to get to a place. The goal is not an infinite number of American troops there for an infinite number of years. The goal is to get the country stabilized in a place where we can begin bringing U.S. combat troops home and reconfiguring to a different mission.
So even if they don't have a good political stability under a Maliki government, it's about time to say, let's focus on the Baker-Hamilton mission, which would mean perhaps, what, one-third of the troops?
Well, look, first of all, Baker-Hamilton, read the report carefully. Page 72, for example, says, we could support a surge of troops if it was necessary and thought by the commanders on the ground to be prudent to stabilize Baghdad, because the Baker-Hamilton Commission recognized that you cannot have the kind of stability we want in Iraq if the capital city, that's one quarter of the population, is unstable. And the purpose of the surge was to do two things. One is to take Anbar, which 6 months ago people were declaring was lost, and to make it not lost, and to stabilize Baghdad so that the government had the space in which it could take steps for political reconciliation. Petraeus says September is the point at which he thinks he'll have the first inkling of what the long-term ramifications are. But we already know a couple of things. We know, first of all, that the level of violence against our troops and the level of IEDs, big IEDs, going off against the civilians is up. We know that sectarian deaths are down. Whether those are long-term trends or what the reaction is going to be in August or September or October, we have yet to see, but we're starting to see some things. And Anbar is probably where we've seen the most remarkable turnaround. Who would have thought 6 months ago that Anbar, which was considered to be lost, we now see the vast majority of the Sunni tribes joining with the central government of Baghdad in an effort called the Awakening, in which the Sunni tribes are staffing up the police and providing personnel for the military, both in Anbar and outside of Anbar, in order to confront the foreign fighters in their midst.
You know, I was reading Secretary Bob Gates and then President Bush's July 4th speech, both of which seem to be pretty clear that we're now thinking, what is the post-surge strategy? What was his main message on July 4th? Because it got many different reporting styles.
Yeah, well, look, he's been saying this thing about our goal is not to have troops there indefinitely in the combat mission that they're in today, but to get to a point where our footprint is smaller, and our mission has been redefined. He's been saying that for months. But the July 4th attempt was to say, on a day where not too many other players are out there at a Air National Guard base in West Virginia to say, in essence, that. And instead they picked up on the paragraph that said there'll be a lot more sacrifice called for in the months ahead as we confront.
But the main point is that we actually will be drawing troops down by next year, probably.
Aspirationally, our goal is to put it in a different place. I'm not going to say when the date is that American troop levels begin to go down. But the goal is to do exactly that, to put ourselves in a place where the U.S. combat footprint is smaller. I mean, the idea is the surge doesn't last indefinitely. The object of the surge is to clear and allow the Iraqis the time to get everything in there to properly hold and to do enough damage to the infrastructure of the enemy that it is hard for the enemy to come back. And,
who's the enemy specifically? Well, Al-Qaeda, Sunni insurgents?
You got essentially three. You got Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is, our intelligence is that 80 to 90% of the bombs going off are AQI. So the object is to get after them in order to deal with that. Then there are Sunni insurgencies that are at war with the government, and the object is to take on those. Now, some of those groups that had problems with the government, like the 1920 Brigade, have now said, okay, there's now a political space that we can now operate in, so we will now turn on those that are not willing to play inside that political space. And the third, frankly, are just criminal elements. I mean, there's, you know, this a lot of some of what we see over there is just, you know, okay, there's a middle-class Iraqi, let's go grab them and hold them for ransom. Or there is a enterprise underway, let's go steal it.
We have a fourth problem, which is all the wacky Shia militia who are extremist Shia.
Well, I'd put them in that third group because, oh. I mean, you know, from the beginning, one of the interesting things is this began with Maliki coming to the president and Amman Jordan saying, I need help in order to take on the Shia militia and the foreign fighters, the Shia militia, because the absence of what he calls a one-gun policy. There ought to be one centralized security force in the country, not competing armies of private militias. This is making it difficult for us to establish control, create political reconciliation, and take on foreign fighters, whose object is the end of the regime.
If you were Maliki's campaign manager, maybe you should be, because he's having some problems. Are we sure he can get his act together?
Well, look, first of all, let's be clear about this. How long has this guy been in power? One year and less than 2 months.
And y'all had invaded Iraq by then. No, not quite. No, I mean, it's a while.
Well, but he's been in, he's in a country that does not know democracy and has no democratic tradition.
So you're saying, yes, you have faith in Maliki.
Yeah. You've got to. Otherwise, your option is to say we should either just walk away and let whatever happen, or we ought to do what was done during the Vietnam War when, you know, the U.S. government in the mid-60s expressed dissatisfaction with the leadership in Vietnam and unilaterally made the decision of replacing an elected government. And I'm not certain we necessarily want to go down that path again.
Mm-hmm. Immigration, you ended last year with a great peroration, I think it was, the need for an immigration reform, comprehensive, and why that it's at the soul of what this country's about. What happened?
Politics got in the way. It's even more important that we do this. And we better, as a country, face up to the problem that we have. And look, I understand the strong emotions about this. I understand that a lot of people wake up and say, I'm worried about America not being America. I understand people who say, I don't like people who came here illegally, and why should they get something? And I know people saying, we should not repeat the mistakes in 1986 when we passed a immigration reform law that basically said, if you came here and you're illegal and you want to be a citizen, raise your right hand. Now, what happened between last year and this is that McCain-Kennedy got defeated. And then some of the opponents of McCain-Kennedy took a sober look after the election and said, is this a problem that we need to confront? And if so, what is it that we most care about in this battle? And some of those opponents came forward. In fact, ironically enough, you know, Congress is a formal institution, but a lot of this happens informally. Part of this sort of sounding each other out back and forth took place during a hunting trip in which two of the opponents of it said, We were opposed to McCain-Kennedy because we're worried about the future flow. How do you remove the magnet, the attraction for future flow of illegal immigrants? You can't remove it entirely by having a temporary worker program. You can only remove the magnet by making it impossible for somebody who's illegal to get hired. So we're willing to engage in discussions about a grand compromise in which we get border security, temporary worker, resolving the status of the 12 million or 8 million, whatever number it is, and as long as a component of that is employee verification in a way that makes it likely that we will not have this repeated again 10 years from now. And thus began all the discussions about that ended up in the grand bargain, in which, you know, for months, Secretary Chertoff and Secretary Guterres met quietly with a wide variety of people on the Hill, Democrats and Republicans, to basically serve as honest brokers, provide facts, encourage the conversation, and we came together with this piece of legislation. They did, and we backed them in doing so. And frankly, you could take any single element of this thing and be unhappy about it. But taken all together as a package, it put America in a very positive new direction on immigration. First of all, it locked into place the things that we're doing on border security, which I want to come back to in a minute. Secondly, it created a temporary worker program where willing workers could be matched with willing employers for jobs that Americans are not doing. And believe me, we're getting tougher on the border, so that it's getting harder for people to get here. And as a result, we're seeing some impact on our labor market. In the early 90s, as I said last year, you could get yourself a coyote for $100 to $150 bucks to get you across the Texas-Mexico border. Today, it's now $2,500. Last year, it was between a range of about $1,500 and I think $2,200, and it's continued to escalate. October of 06, they count Texas and Oklahoma for ag labor reporting statistics as one market, and they give an annual number, October over October. October of 06 over October of 05, there are 23% fewer farm laborers in Oklahoma and Texas than there were in 05, and wages are 7% higher. Now, I don't think there are one quarter fewer farm workers because we're growing one quarter fewer cows and crops. It's getting that much harder to get across the border. So, willing worker, match with a willing employer in a temporary worker program. Employer verification, which was one of the elements that allowed us to bring people across from no to yes. And what employer verification said was, look, we've got a lot of very good corporate citizens in America trying to do the right thing. But it is impossible for us to do this with the system that we now have in place. A woman came to me with a landscaping company and said, I hire 12 or 13 people a year. Don't count on me to be an expert in document fraud. And we saw a clear example of this in the Swift meatpacking plant case. One of the things that we've done as an administration is we've said we're going to have a policy of deliberately going after people who knowingly hire illegal aliens. Now, Swift did not knowingly hire illegal aliens, but we stumbled onto the back end of a process that was involved in providing fraudulent documents to people to go get a job with Swift. Now, Swift was a good corporate citizen. They had an HR department that asked the right questions. They had lawyers advising them, so they went up right to the line. They did everything they possibly could to advertise widely for workers as broadly as possible and give training programs and so forth so that there was no excuse for if somebody wanted a job that paid 16, 18, 20 bucks an hour in little towns across America where they had plants, they had a chance to apply. And yet when we went in and went through five of their plants, between a quarter and 40% of their workers were illegal. And they were able to get jobs because they showed up with driver's licenses, birth certificates, and other documents, which to the eye of a very highly trained human resources department look like legitimate documents. So the employee verification part of this was really, really important. And then finally, the issue of resolving the situation of the 12 million. We didn't repeat the mistake of 86 where it said, you know, raise your hand, you're now a citizen of the Estados Unidos. We said, if you want to become a U.S. citizen, you got to surface. And the first thing we're going to do is we're going to take your 10 fingerprints, and while you're sitting there, we're going to check those 10 fingerprints. This may surprise you. You know how many fingerprint checks are done every day in America? On average, 3.2 million. So doing a couple hundred thousand more fingerprint checks, because it's all electronic, just put it on the pad, takes a picture, runs it against the database. So we can find out, did you do something bad while you've been here? We're going to give you a card, and over the next 2 months, we're going to then go do more background checks on you. And if you then want to stay in the United States as a temporary worker, you pay a fine and a processing fee. And you pay an impact fee, to help relieve some of the local governments of the cost of health and education. You get to stay for 4 years. At the end of 4 years, if you want to stay another 4 years, you have to pay another fine and fee. You stay 4 more years, and then if you want to adjust your status and get in the line to get a green card, you have to go to a U.S. consulate outside the United States, pay another processing fee to pay the cost of the whole project, and then wait up to 5 years to get your green card in order to then become a citizen. During this whole process, at the beginning, you have to demonstrate that you either have English proficiency or you're enrolled in a class to help you learn to read, write, and speak English. And at the end of the process, before you can become a United States citizen, you have to show that you can read, write, and speak English and take a civics test that is more than where is the capital of the United States, A, Washington, B, Buffalo, C, Aspen. Now, this was a good bill. It had flaws, and I could point to, you know, there are things that we didn't like, there are things that everybody didn't like. But it put us on a rational course. It also did a couple other things that were really important to the future of the country. We have an immigration system today that says there is a priority for you coming into the country based on whether you are related to somebody already here. If you are an uncle or an aunt or a mom or a dad or a brother or sister, niece or nephew, you get more points and get a higher priority. This dialed the system away from that to say that the priority is now on the three E's. Do you have education, employment history, or English skills that would tend to indicate that you'd be a positive contribution to society? We still kept family in there, but rather than being dialed dominantly towards family, we moved it so that it was more towards, a majority was now towards the three E's. The other thing we got is a system in which people who want to become a U.S. citizen wait forever to become a U.S. citizen. And as part of the grand bargain, we said that everybody who's standing in line today is going to be processed in the next 8 years. Because some of those people will have to wait 20 and 30 years to come into the United States legally if the system continues as it was. Now, it's a good system, but it is, I readily admit, a contentious and enormously, it's something that's deeply emotional to people. Now, I will also suggest to you that it is based on a lack of information about the thing that scares them the most, and that is what's being done to secure our borders. Mm-hmm. I've had an unusual experience the last couple of months going around the country doing some mostly Republican Party things to sort of, you know, relieve the sentiment, you know, sort of let them be heard about it. And, of course, they always have the ugly question about immigration. So I want you to participate in a little mental exercise with me. I want you to think about last year, and I want you to get fixed in your mind the number of people that you think we apprehended at the border and returned back outside the United States of America. Now, I suspect you're not the normal audience that I've been talking to recently about this, so you might have a slightly different number, but everybody get fixed on a number. Anybody want to suggest to me what your number is? 10,000? 50,000? 1,000,003. Last year we had 1,000,003 that we apprehended and returned across the border. Nearly 1,000,000 of them were Canadians or Mexicans who get apprehended and returned literally either the same day or within 24 hours. We also returned 280,000 people who had to go through some formal removal process. 95,000 of them had committed another crime. We put a special emphasis on seeking out aliens inside the United States who have committed a crime. So we've kicked out 95,000 of them. There are 81,000 that are OTMs, other than Mexicans. That's actually an official term in government lingo.
Other than Mexicans?
Now, the reason is because if you are a Canadian or a Mexican, we have the legal authority to basically toss you back across the border. If you are an OTM, we have to have an agreement in place with your home country as to how we will process you out of the country. This is the group that heretofore has been subject to catch and release. If we caught you, we released you. And we gave you a little piece of paper and said, here's your immigration court hearing, please show up. And for the last 30 years, 92% of them have not shown up. And I'm not certain it's in the interest of the United States to retain the other 8%. I mean, and then we had 37,000 that had previously had a so-called removal order against them. This may surprise you. Of the people who are here illegally in the United States today, one-third of them came here legally. They came here on a visa and overstayed. So this latter category are people who overstayed their visa. We knew when their visa was up. At some point long after their visa was up, we went to court and sanctioned them, so we had a formal removal order waiting for them. Now, I asked this to be tracked. If you don't measure it, you can't solve it. So we started tracking in 2004 the gap between those that we caught on OTMs and those that we removed. And it was big and pretty consistent. So we tried an experiment in 2005 at DHS called Operation Texas Hold'em. Because Brazilians came across the border primarily in the lower Rio Grande Valley sector of the border, and also to a lesser extent the Laredo. But that's virtually every Brazilian who enters the U.S. illegally comes there. So we said, okay, we're going to take whatever amount of resources are necessary and grab every Brazilian, and we're not going to let a single one of them go. And we're going to do whatever is necessary in the way of extraordinary resources to house them, hold the hearing, and process them out of the country, and see if this doesn't have a result back in Brazil. So the message is, you come up, you get on the plane from Rio, you get yourself to Mexico City, you get on the bus to the border, you hire the coyote, you get across the border, they grab you, and you no longer, you know what they call your immigration hearing notice in Brazil? A permiso, a permission slip. So no longer will you get the permiso, instead you'll get put in a cell, you'll get processed, and put on a plane back to Rio. And we did this, and it cost a lot of money. But what we found is that 6 weeks later, apprehensions of Brazilians coming across the border in Texas had dropped 90%. Now, the reason wasn't that they were getting a lot smarter and getting across. It was that the message got out, we're going to get caught and get returned. So this, we then began, we had been putting resources into it. We've got 40% more beds to hold these people, 7,700 more beds to hold people. So it's costly. But it is really vital that we do this in order to have people have confidence that we're serious about controlling the border. Because if we don't, if people think that we've got this, and we've had this for 30 years, Republicans and Democrats alike have tolerated this. And it has been corrosive in people's attitudes towards the border. Just is. It's not giving people confidence that their government is on their side when it comes to the border. But this isn't enough to solve the problem. We better work on all the other problems of this, assimilation, resolving the status of the people who are here illegally, worker, employer verification, and temporary worker program, or this is all not going to matter, because they're going to be, you don't have enough resources to control the border if people are desperate to feed themselves and there's a job in the United States of America that allows them to feed their kids. Just aren't.
President Bush's top political advisor, Karl Rove, speaking earlier this month at the Aspen Ideas Festival in a session moderated by the Aspen Institute's Walter Isaacson. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Last year, when we talked about the Valerie Plame Wilson case, you said, it's still under adjudication, hard to talk about. I think Scott McClellan at one point came out and said you had nothing to do with any of this, but it turns out you did and others did.
What he said was I didn't have anything to do with revealing her name. Now, look, this is still in a civil case, which is motions are pending on.
Yeah.
But my contribution to this was to say to a reporter, which is a lesson about talking to reporters, the words, I heard that too.
Yeah. There were a lot of people in the administration putting her name out, it seems, and they were doing it to discredit Joe Wilson. And it seemed like a concerted effort, and nobody came forward and said...
I disagree.
Why didn't you come forward and say, I said it, and here's why I said it?
I did.
No, I mean publicly before Matt Cooper gets...
Because the FBI said, don't say anything about this.
But, it seems like a lot of people kept quiet in the administration, having put her name forward, causing a whole rigmarole that probably could have been prevented.
Yeah, I don't agree with you a whole lot. In fact, the record pretty well shows that it is one used her name.
Scooter or Armitage?
Armitage. And Scooter uses it after the story has already been largely picked up and written by Novak.
Why did people put her name out?
But look, here's a guy who goes and says, in his article, the Vice President of the United States sent me, Vice President of the United States raised questions, so I was sent, apparently at the insistence of the Vice President, to go check it out, and I came back and reported. I would only recommend you read the July 11th statement by the Director of the CIA, who says, he was not sent at the direction of the White House or the Vice President. He was not sent at the direction of the Director of the CIA. He did not come back and give a written report. He came back and gave a verbal report, which was considered to be neither conclusive nor dispositive. In fact, he didn't come back disproving that Iraq had attempted to acquire uranium yellow cake from Niger. He came back with a previously unknown incident where they tried to do exactly that.
But why didn't y'all just openly say that instead of off the record using the name of his wife?
We did. In fact, that's my conversation with Bob Novak is largely about that. And my only contribution is when he says, I've talked to, she had something to do with it, and I said, I've heard that too.
And Matt Cooper, same?
Matt Cooper, I don't remember the conversation with Matt Cooper, but even his own notes of it are, it is an off-the-record conversation on Friday morning when I know that Novak's column has been written and is going to be published, and that the CIA is coming out with a statement that says Joe Wilson was not sent at the direction of the CIA or the CIA director or the vice president, was not dispositive, not conclusive, in fact, added to the case, didn't detract from the case, and was suspect because of the methods that he used to collect the data. And I'm trying to tell Matt Cooper, by his own notes, you ought not to be writing. Don't get ahead of yourself on this. Don't be writing about this thing for Time magazine.
Were you involved in the discussions about commuting Libby's prison sentence, and what did you think of it?
No. And look, I think the president's statement, I thought, was absolutely hit the right tone, which was respectful of the decision that he was guilty of misleading the grand jury, but with a no underlying offense, excessive in its application of the penalty.
Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot about energy, both in terms of energy security, like why have we allowed the price of oil to go from $10 a barrel to $70 or $80, and we're sending all that money to Ahmadinejad and the Saudis, and people are going to use it against us, and also about the carbon and what it's doing to our problems with global warming. Is there a sense that you could do something dramatic in this next year to really try to reduce both our dependence on foreign oil more than the 2010, and reduce the emissions of carbon?
Yes, there is something. And 20 and 10 is the proposal the president laid out in the State of the Union address, which a Supreme Court decision then said we had authority under existing authority, which we didn't think we had, but they said we do have, to in essence put the 20 and 10 plan largely in place by regulatory structures. 20 and 10 basically aims to reduce our petroleum use by 20% in the next 10 years. And the object is that 20% represents about the percentage of our oil supply that we get from the Persian Gulf. Now, the reason that oil prices are high is that world demand is high, particularly because of the escalation of demand in China and India. And the world production is relatively flat, and if demand is rising, then you're going to get an increase in price.
How much do you worry about climate change? Is it overblown? Is it a real worry?
Yeah, it's a real worry. The question is, it's you got to buy an insurance policy. We don't know. You know, I've labored through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, not just the very short introduction, but the all god dang 800 pages of the thing or whatever it was.
777.
Yeah, there's a lot we don't know. We're putting a lot of money into climate science. We put $37 billion into climate research since we came into office. We put more, and the United States puts more into climate research than the rest of the world combined. And there's a lot that we don't know. But we've got to do, our view is what we ought to do, it's prudent to begin to reduce the growth rate to stabilize and eventually aim by the middle of the century to be in a position where we can begin to reduce. And we need to do this in a way in which all the players are at the table. One of the problems with Kyoto was all the players were not at the table. And we've got to do it in a way that we don't impede economic growth, because economic growth is the way that we're going to be able to put in place the technologies necessary to deal with greenhouse gas emissions.
And you don't think green technology will promote economic growth in this country compared to other countries?
Look,
that's a Tom Friedman argument you've heard of.
Look, I think it may...
I'm
going to point to Greenspan, who I think depicts this as an accounting question. But look, I'm not going to... Nobody suggests, look, if it was economically advantageous for everybody to adopt these technologies today, they'd be adopting them. Because, in essence, efficiency means that you're using what you got, the energy source, a heck of a lot more efficiently means you're using more of it, using less of it to get more out of it.
If you're actually paying for all the costs, though, of emitting CO2,
what is the cost?
Is the future generations.
Well, we don't know what the future cost is. So the question is, do we say, okay, we got to put the brakes on economic growth, we got to put the brakes on bringing people up out of poverty in the developing world, we got to change dramatically the way that we do things here in America and impose it upon people because we're fearful of what might be 50 or 100 years out, or do we begin to take prudent steps now? We're in the prudent steps camp. For example, look, one of the big worries we've got is China. The economy is one-fifth as large as the United States, and this year will pass us in order to be the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases. Think about that. One-fifth our size, and they're putting out more greenhouse gases than we are.
Are we leveling off on greenhouse
gas? Yeah, in fact, yeah. Thank you for asking that question. We've increased our energy consumption by 47.5%. We've increased our population by 45%. So our population and energy consumption have gone up roughly together. Our CO2 emissions have gone up 41.5%. Our what's called criteria air pollutant emissions, think of it as pollution, has gone down 52%. So we have shown over this period of time, despite the fact that the economy has grown pretty dramatically, the population has grown pretty well, we're driving a heck of a lot more. At least when it comes to pollution, we've done a much better job of reducing the bad stuff that's coming into our air. And in 2006, the United States of America is the only major industrial country in the world to see an absolute decline in the greenhouse gas emissions. 2006. We're the only country in the world. Since 1990, CO2 emissions have increased an average of about 1.1% annually. That's while our economy has been growing at, over that period of time, a larger rate. 2005, CO2 emissions were 0.06, 0.6, and we were growing the economy at 3.2%. And then in 2006, they decreased 1.6%, and we had economic growth of 3.3. Now, it's not just because of the policies, and it's not just because of the investment. It also has to do with weather patterns. But nonetheless, it does show that there is a reasonable and prudent policy which will allow us, if applied universally, to stabilize and then begin to reduce greenhouse gas emissions without hurting the economy. Now, what we got to do is we laid the predicate for this a couple of years ago with the Asia-Pacific Partnership, where we said, let's get together with Australia, Japan, China, Korea, India, and anybody else in the basin that wants to participate with us, and let's talk about ways that we can attack climate change problems by reducing barriers to the transmission of technology, whether it's the barrier of a tariff or the barrier of a lack of resources, or whatever the barrier is to getting these technologies that reduce greenhouse gas emissions into the hands of people who need them in order to use the fuel that they got more efficiently. How can we make this a good business decision for people to begin doing? And we've been working at that in the Asia basin for the last 3 years. The interesting thing about G8 is G8 said, let's restart the Kyoto process. We said, no, why don't we take the model that we have of cooperation and progress in the basin and make it national, international. Let's get everybody, all the major emitters, to use that same process that says we will set a national goal for stabilization and ultimate reduction, and we will examine those policies that keep us from adopting technologies that will allow us to do that.
Why didn't we find some version of a Kyoto-like agreement in which we could have said, we're doing this, so we should...
Well, that's our object. Our object is we have our first meeting this fall with all the major polluters, all the major emitters. They're not called polluters because not everybody agrees that it's a pollutant. They agree that it's an emission. So we got all the major emitters together for the conference this fall. And look, I know how tough the work was in the Asia partnership, but I also know that it has set in motion a whole series of things that are going to be very positive with regard to, I mean, if you get people focused on the question of efficiency, how are we using the energy that we've got efficiently? Suddenly it causes the Chinese to say, you know what, is it worth us to have a giant German diesel sitting behind every production plant because our transmission grid is so bad? Does that make sense? Or does it make sense to put some money into making the transmission grid better? Mm-hmm. And suddenly you go, does it make sense? And some of these decisions take decades. UK is now getting into a place where the UK is stabilizing and may shortly be able to flatline and reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. And you know why? Because in the 1970s, Margaret Thatcher broke the back of the coal union and said, I'm putting Britain on a path to nuclear power.
Why aren't we getting on a path to nuclear power?
We are. We have 21 or 22 license applications in process to bring back nuclear power. And look, we got hundreds of years at coal, and most of our power, 50% of our electric power, comes from coal. So the question is, what can we do to make that stuff burn cleaner?
You talk about carbon sequestration.
Carbon sequestration. But we also, look, there are a whole bunch of coal plants today that exist that if retrofitted would put out a lot less gunk. That's where our biggest bang for the buck is. And what we've done is we think the approximate cost of that, and industry agrees, is approximately $10 billion. And under the energy bill we passed several years ago, we got the ability to put out tax credits. We put out last year $1 billion in tax credits. This year we'll put out $650 million more to offset part of the $10 billion that industry is putting in to, again, make their plants more efficient, which thereby has less NOx, SOx, and mercury, and less greenhouse gases, while at the same time they burn their fuel more efficiently. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to make this a good economic decision. We recognize that tax credits are a distortion of the system, but, you know, most of our emissions come from automobiles, but the emissions that we can do something about in a rapid fashion are out of power plants and industrial facilities.
White House political advisor Karl Rove, speaking July 8th at the Aspen Ideas Festival, which is organized by The Atlantic Magazine and the Aspen Institute. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. Following his conversation with Aspen Institute President and CEO Walter Isaacson, Karl Rove took questions from the audience. We regret you will not be able to hear the questions as they were asked. Rove and the Aspen Institute agreed that while audience members would be allowed to ask questions, they wouldn't be allowed to ask those questions into a microphone. Absent a recording, we will paraphrase the questions as they were posed to the president's political advisor. Some of the questions dealt with the U.S. relationship with Pakistan and its president, Pervez Musharraf. That day's New York Times reported that in early 2005, then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld called off a secret military operation to capture senior members of al-Qaeda in Pakistan. According to the article, Rumsfeld was concerned in part that the operation could cause a rift with the Pakistani government. Karl Rove's response.
This is way outside my lane, so I can't help you on this. I do know there is a sensitivity about the United States taking actions that would destabilize Musharraf. And there's also the United States has concerns about taking unilateral action in a sovereign nation without their approval. And so this has always been the difficulty we have with unless, of course, they're Saddam Hussein. Is Musharraf an ally in the war on terror? Yeah. But we also have to recognize that the tribal region of Pakistan, abutting Afghanistan, has been no man's land, Wild West, for almost since the beginning of the country. And it's difficult for the central government to project its authority there. They're doing a heck of a lot better job today than they were before 2001, steadily, we think, making improvements. Could they do better? I bet. Am I a person who knows what they have done and what they should do? No. Sorry, can't help you on that.
General Powell.
Powell can tell you up through early 05, but I can't.
General Powell.
Walter Isaacson addressing former Secretary of State Colin Powell, who stood up to address Karl Rove. Again, the reason you can't hear him very well is that Rove and the Aspen Institute decided questioners would not be allowed to ask their questions into a microphone. General Powell wanted to give his perspective on the leak that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA. Colin Powell said that the former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage told the FBI everything about his role in the affair, but that investigations continued because others involved in the leak were not coming forward. Powell continued to say, quoting here, "If everybody who had any contact with a reporter during that period had done what Armitage had done, I think this would have ended early on, not dragged out the way it has." On mic, here's Karl Rove's response.
Let me just add one comment to that. A lot of people visited with the FBI, including me, before October 2nd. So you're right. Right from the beginning, people came forward and said, here's the contact we had.
But the implication is, if everybody had come forward right away, said, here's what I did and why I did it, we wouldn't have gone through this.
I'm not certain that's accurate. I think everybody did. And the question was,
Dick Cheney?
I think the question then became checking everybody's stories against each other. You remember, the underlying offense of Armitage talking to Novak, There was no indictment. There's no violation there. This really became a question of, at the end of the day, comparing everybody's statements to everybody else's statements and saying, are there inconsistencies?
Former Secretary of State Colin Powell followed up, saying he agreed with Rove that there was no crime committed. The following question for Rove asked how personally responsible he felt for the war in Iraq. The questioner asked why Rove stated that al-Qaeda is the single biggest cause of violence in Iraq.
Yeah, look, it is a fact that 85 to 90% of the IEDs going off in Iraq are AQ.
Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda.
Right?
And Look, I make no apologies. It was the right thing to do. The world is better off with him gone. We all thought he had weapons of mass destruction. The whole world did. He didn't. But I'll tell you this. Go back and read the Dulfler and the Kay reports. Both of them say the same thing, which is that while they found that he did not, they did find that he kept in place the experts and scientists, the knowledge base, if you will, to recreate these weapons. He kept together the dual-use facilities, which could be for biological and chemical weapons, put back into operation relatively quickly. And he kept the desire. He wanted the world to think that he had them. Remember, this guy has his entire country under 16 UN resolutions over the decades of the 90s saying you need to live up to your commitment made in the aftermath of the Gulf War to disclose and cough all this stuff up. He could have gotten rid of that onerous regime of regulation by the United Nations by simply saying, you know what, I got rid of this stuff, I don't have it anymore, and here's what I did with it. But instead, he wanted the world to think that he had it. Now, the world is better off with him gone. Now, in the aftermath of the withdrawal of the removal of the regime, al-Qaeda decided to make its stand in Iraq. And we have not to, in my opinion, fight them and win them and beat them there. Otherwise, we're going to face them someplace else. And if we don't fight and beat and win there, they're going to have not Afghanistan with very little in the way of natural resources stuck far out on the periphery of the world from which they struck us on 9/11. They're going to have a country in the heart of the Middle East with the third largest oil reserves in the world. It is, unfortunately, the challenge of our generation to engage in a worldwide struggle against terror. And I think General Abizaid was right. Iraq will either be the beginning of the end of the global war on terror when we win, or it will be the beginning of the beginning of the war on terror if we lose.
Jane Harman.
U.S. Congresswoman Jane Harman, a Democrat from California, stood up to ask White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove a question. Harman referred back to the New York Times article about former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld calling off a secret operation to capture senior members of al-Qaeda in early 2005. She asked Rove if the Bush administration is seriously focused on getting the top al-Qaeda people or not. Here's what Karl Rove had to say.
Yeah, well, obviously we are. But as you know, and you know better than most, the questions of the quality of the intelligence is, and I, you and I, you're in a better position to know about the quality of the intelligence and the incident involved than I am. But there are subjective judgments about the quality of the intelligence as to whether or not Zawahiri was there or not, what's the quality of it. We also have issues of the assets from the Defense Department. If this was a CIA operation, were they depending on how did Rumsfeld get involved? Was it involved because he had to provide assets for it, in which case he has a seat at the table to say, is this an operation that I feel confident we have, A good intelligence that leads us to believe that this is likely to be true, and two, have we taken the steps necessary to get our presumptive ally here involved in this, and three, do I believe that this is appropriate and proper use of the assets? That is to say, do we have a chance of succeeding? I wasn't at that table. You weren't at that table. Those are subjective judgments that we need to rely upon the people sitting around that table to make. And I'm not going to jump to depicting a story in the New York Times as being the end-all, be-all on a sophisticated intelligence operation like this may or may not have been.
White House Deputy Chief of Staff and political advisor Karl Rove at the Aspen Ideas Festival. The questioners are off mic, as was decided by the festival and Karl Rove. One questioner asked about poverty in America. Rove said the president feels that the gap between the rich and poor will grow wider if we don't deal with our education system. And he talked about visiting a school in Harlem recently with U.S. Congressman Charles Rangel, a Democrat from New York.
And Rangel said less than 40% of the students in his high schools in his district in Harlem graduate from high school.
Less than 40%?
Less than 40%. And, I mean, how can we as a country in which we're increasingly a knowledge-based society hope to have everybody moving ahead if we aren't able to graduate black, brown, poor kids from high school and give them a chance to go on to college? Now, there's a lot going on in America that's very positive. More people are going to college today in history as a percentage of the kids graduating from high school and as a percentage of all young people. We're at a record numbers, and they're getting a quality education. May not be at, you know, UCLA, but it's at their community college, and maybe they go on to the four-year institute, state institution. But they're getting a quality higher education. Our problem is K-1 through 12, where there are gross disparities across this country, And it is on the basis of a system that does not function. I'll tell you, I was in New York City on that same visit. And we went to a school in Harlem in which the number of students was enough that they only needed three floors of the school. So they gave the fourth floor of the school over to a charter school. And I got to tell you, it was inspiring. There was this, I sat in this classroom. It was a math class for fifth and sixth graders. I talked to their teacher. The kid went to Harvard. After he got out of school, he said, I'm going to go work in the public school system as a teacher, science teacher. And he worked in the public school system, and he said, I hated it. And I said, well, what did you hate about public education? He said, I hate the unions. He said, they make it impossible for good teachers to succeed. They breed mediocrity. They took good teachers and dragged them down. The system has got to be blown up, and the only way to blow it up is through charters and choice, and that's why I'm here. Now, I got to thinking about this incredibly bright, articulate math major from Harvard and what this kid could be making in our marketplace as a, you know, I mean, God, what kind of future has that guy got? And that guy is devoted to teaching on the fourth floor with no elevator of a school in Harlem. Now, it says something about people's willingness to tackle this problem. It says something about the challenge that we face, because it's not just Harlem. It is Dallas. It's New Orleans. It's, you know, it's rural Colorado. We have a system that is not based upon measuring every child, identifying whether having high standards, measuring children against those standards, asking whether or not the system is getting them taught what they need, providing extra help to get them up to speed. That's what No Child Left Behind aims to do. And it's starting to have an impact. It blows me away that even as we start to put this into place, and we got a lot of things that we got to work out, kinks to work out in it, and we rely upon the state setting the standards. So we got states that say, oh, yeah, our standard is see Jane run. And others say it is what it ought to be. But even though it's imperfect, we have seen more improvement in reading math scores in the last 5 years since it was adopted, K-1 through 12, than in the previous 28 years combined.
The final question for Karl Rove came from Walter Isaacson, president and CEO of the Aspen Institute and moderator of the event. Isaacson asked the president's political advisor what the biggest issue of the 2008 campaign would be.
I think Iraq may or may not be the big issue. It depends on where Iraq is by March or April or May of next year. I think it's likely not to be the dominant issue because I think because of my assumptions about where it is, where I think it's likely to be. I think it may also be less of an issue because if you're a Democrat, you do not want to be in a place where on January 21st, 2009, if a Democrat gets elected president, the Democrat president faces the likelihood there'll be U.S. troops in Iraq. And so if you want the issue to be toned down, because you don't want to be in a place where on January 21, if you're a Democrat and you get elected, you face one of two options. You bring them home precipitously, and everybody, virtually everybody agrees the country descends into chaos, and that's on your watch, or that you keep them there in a reasonable configuration, redeployed, and in which case a large part of your party is angry with you. So I think this is sort of like Korea in 1952 and 53, where Eisenhower made a comment which led people to believe that he was for change, I'll go to Korea, but in essence kept in place the policies of Truman after the election. And for Republicans, I think again, similarly, they'd like to be able to talk about taxes, spending, values, national security, but in a broader context, national security in a broader context than just Iraq. But I'll tell you this, it is going to be a barn burner of a race. It's going to be a barn burner of a race because the process is so jammed together that the country, I think, is going to ill-serve the candidates and ill-serve the country. But, you know, you have within the space of less than 2 weeks, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Florida. Now, we had Iowa, which we won, and 8 days later, New Hampshire, which we lost, and 19 days later, South Carolina, where we were able to climb back and win. What happens when you compress four major primaries into essentially 12 days. Wow. And as a result, what's going to happen is we're going into uncharted territory as to how is the early winter in Iowa going to affect New Hampshire? Is the winter in New Hampshire going to affect South Carolina? It did last time. Iowa didn't affect New Hampshire, but New Hampshire affected South Carolina. We went from being 16 up in South Carolina the day before the New Hampshire primary to 6 down 24 hours later. And is that going to, you know, is somebody going to win someplace in a way that grabs the national imagination? We also are going to have a contest. Think about this. We're on now the 8th of July. In 1999, George W. Bush had made his first campaign appearance on June 16th. He'd had his first campaign fundraiser on the 19th of June. On the 30th of June, at $1,000 a clip, he reported a grand total of $37 million. We had, in the 99-2000 campaign, we had 150 campaign staffers, I think, on or about September of 2000, over a year from now. So these guys have all been running. I mean, we've already had how many debates? I mean, these people have been running flat out since last November. They have a campaign, you know, they were appearing last November and December at a pace that was equivalent to what we were appearing at in November and December of 99 and January of 2000. Now, is that healthy? No. Because, first of all, they're going to be exhausted by the time they get chosen. And then they're going to go into a bone-charring general election, and that's going to take more out of them. So they're going to somebody's going to get elected president and be completely exhausted. And they will not have had time to think for 2 years. I mean, part of what they're doing, you know, when Obama goes to the debate on health care in Nevada in February and stands up and says, I don't have a health care plan, but I'll have one by next January, it shows that the pace of this thing is outrunning the substantive process. People are not having time to sit down and think and walk these things through and put the numbers together and listen to interesting minds and be challenged and develop what it is that they want to say that is something beyond the press guy coming in saying, here's your soundbite for this afternoon. And that is really problematic and not helpful for the country.
Carl, thanks for being here.
White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove speaking July 8th at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. If you missed part of today's speech by the president's top political advisor, Karl Rove, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. There, you may also sign up for our free podcast or listen to any of our previous programs, including other Aspen Ideas Festival sessions with former Secretary of State Colin Powell and former President Bill Clinton. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencala.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert and Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. We had lots of help this week from Kyle Sisko, and the technical director is Sam Keenan. American Public Media.